What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Copy Blogger Podcast. My name is Tim Stoddard. Thank you so much for joining me. As always, I am with my co-host, Ethan Brooks. Ethan, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. Happy Friday. What's going on?
Busy week. Yeah, busy week. We we worked hard this week, man. It was a very, very successful week from the side of digital commerce. A lot of the things that we were experimenting with that, as you do, you're not quite sure if they're going to work, but you kind of feel like they should. They all started working really well. And so that has me feeling really, really encouraged to finish off the week. But thanks for asking. What about you?
This week, this is good. So I typically front load my weeks. Just so everybody knows, we record this on a Friday. This is like my Sunday. So yeah. Saturday, Sunday are my first 2 days of the work week. And those are busy, long days, research, writing, all that kind of stuff. Monday is crazy. That's when we build the email. So there's like a lot of technical stuff, a lot of back and forth. And then the rest of the week is just kind of gliding off that work pattern. So it's much, by the time we get to this, I'm like relaxed and kind of downshifted. But it is always a little bit weird that everybody else is like heading into the weekend. And I'm like, yeah, getting ready to get back to work tomorrow. So
funny. I never knew that.
Yeah, it's been good, man. I think we'll talk about this a little bit in this show, but I'm testing something too. So you're testing some new marketing stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm testing a product idea. We'll get into that in a minute. But before we do, I wanted to close the loop on something because a couple of weeks ago we had this podcast about relaunching Sober Nation. Talk to me a little bit about where that currently stands. Has there been any movement there, or what's the news?
Well, there's been a ton of movement. However, we didn't launch it. And you can see on the staging site, if you want to, the reason why we didn't launch it. So have you ever seen the Elon Musk documentary about SpaceX? It's on Netflix right now.
No.
Well, it's good. You should watch it. I think it's called like, I don't know, something about outer space. But there's a line in there where he said, there's nothing else that we possibly could have prepared for. And as he said that, it hit me. Where me and David, my partner, and I have been going back and forth about the site navigation. And as you hover over the links on the site navigation, what the pages should be on the dropdown. Because you got to remember, we're putting ourselves in the position of either somebody who is like currently in crisis mode, struggling with addiction, or a family member. Mm-hmm. And so when I heard that, I called David the very next day and I said, David, I'm so proud of you. Like, the site structure is awesome. You're going to hate me. But I think we need to like really, really go through the navigation bar with a fine tooth comb just to make sure that our site experience is everything that it should be. So this week, we have been doing that. I'll put a link in the show notes to the actual staging site. You guys can look at it yourself. I think it's just newsn.wpengine.staging.com. But yeah, we'll put a link in there. And when you hover over the navigation, I think you will really, really recognize that the guides and the resources are like in the perfect order to meet people where they are. So the loop is still open. Like, we haven't closed it, but I promise you it is not from a lack of effort. It is sincerely from a paranoid, terrified perspective that I am in.
Well, this is interesting. So let me ask you a follow-up question about this, because I know you're a Seth Godin guy. Yeah. And he's got this concept when it comes to launching projects that he calls thrashing, which you're familiar, but just for everybody who may not be, the idea is this, like, the closer you get to your launch date, the more problems people are going to find with the product in order to keep it from going out the door. And so his solution is, like, you have to set out in the beginning very clear rules for what it means to launch. And then there has to be basically one person who can hit that launch button and not a lot of people that can stop them. How are you handling that? Because, and the, one of the reasons I'm asking is, I mentioned I'm experimenting with this product idea and I'm experiencing some thrash there too. So I'll talk about that. But for you, how do you tell the difference between a last minute change that you really need to do and a last minute change that's really just thrashing? And specifically, how do you avoid the thrashing on your team for projects like this?
Yeah, I am totally a proponent for publishing stuff before it's done. And I mean that quite literally. If you look at some of my websites, so for instance, on timstoddard.com, I have a course that I give away for free. And the course is halfway done. And it's still just like, hey, take this for free. And like, I come in once a week and I'll write another lesson. And then I'll be like, hey, I wrote another lesson. Here you go. You can take it. So I have absolutely no problem putting unpolished work out there for the world to see. The difference with Sober Nation is that it's not like it's a new project where there's consequences, real significant consequences to putting it up before it meets like a certain spec or a certain demand, right? Because I could totally leave it alone and never touch it again and just get paid, you know? And so who would ever change something that is like a relatively passive cash flowing asset? A crazy person like me who's like never settled and nothing is ever good enough and like there's always something else to prove. So it's I'm kind of contradicting myself here, because if you look at my work, you'll see everywhere unpolished work being published because you got to hit publish. Mm-hmm. In this case though, I do think the context is a little bit different, because the last thing I want to do is like jump off a cliff and be like, well, I jumped, and then splat on the way down, right? So,
to answer your
question, David can publish at any time. David really does have the control, and if he says we're going live, we're going live, and that's his call.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, to your point too, with some projects, it wouldn't necessarily be you who jumped. It's almost like the user jumps, right? So, Sober Nation in particular, as you mentioned, speaks to people who are in crisis mode. And I think there are some times when, as a creator, you have a responsibility to put out something that is better than just an MVP. Yeah, I think this is becoming more popular in startup circles too. And I don't know if it's because technology is changing or maybe our generation of entrepreneurs is just maturing a little bit. But for a long time, there was this concept of move fast and break things. And it works. You get a lot more reps in, and I think you get feedback faster. But it's also kind of created this ecosystem where like nothing's good anymore. You know, like what was the last great piece of software that you really downloaded? I can tell you the one that it was for me. It was Descript, which is awesome. But like everything's kind of half done, and you get kind of sick of that. And now there's like this change in the air where people are saying, well, maybe you take a little bit more time, put out something that's worthwhile and it's going to last. And I think that also comes just with like financial runway. It's a little easier to make those kinds of decisions.
Yeah. When there's like blank checks that go on forever where.
Yeah. Or even just a little cushion, you know, you're not like scrapping for your next meal. Mark Zuckerberg talked about this on Tim's podcast too. So Facebook's motto used to be move fast and break things.
Break things.
Yeah. And he said, you know, for a long time that actually worked. And to some extent, it's still a good way of thinking about development. But as they got bigger and bigger and bigger, they actually got to a point where it took more time to go back and fix all the tickets. Sure. Yeah. Than it would have to just spend a little bit extra time on creation. So I think that's something that people need to think about as they're introducing a product into the world. And the other one, and this I think ties into what I'm struggling with right now, is how much love do you have for the thing that you're building? So for you, I know Sober Nation is like close to home, right? It's not the same thing as just white labeling some course or creating, you know, lead flow for car wash, like car detailing companies. I'm going through something similar with this notebook company, which we can get into, but is there anything else you want to say about Sober Nation?
That I will let you know as soon as it goes live. I'm excited for it. I think you're probably right. There is an emotional aspect for me where I feel like an obligation, you know, and I don't want to let people down because it's a site that's like much bigger than me, right? Where my Tim Stodds blog or copy blogger is the same way, where you don't want to let people down. But I think you're right. The culture of writing and people understand that it's better to publish imperfect work than to never publish your perfect work, right? So we can kind of get away with that. But there isn't just the immediate urgency of the user in the same way that there is with Sober Nation. So I could be struggling with a little bit of like, I don't know, there's a complex named for it, but I'm in too deep with it emotionally, you know, like I'm clouded by my own emotion. that could be the case, but no, I do feel like we are approaching this as logically as possible. And when we do hit publish, if the whole thing crashes and burns, I will know in my heart that there wasn't anything else that we could have done.
That's good. That works.
Yeah. Ethan, enough about me. I am dying to hear. Come on. You've been teasing me with this notebook company all week. What are we doing? How's it going?
Yeah. So it's going for our beloved listeners. I'm trying not to say for everybody listening, because Tim called me on that last week. He's like, you say for everybody listening all the time, like, hey, for everybody listening to this. And when we realized, yeah, everybody's listening. Everybody, yeah. Literally everybody except for you and me. Okay. So if I say that, I'm sorry for everybody listening. So I've got this idea. I want to start a side project, and there's a few reasons for it. One, obviously, is cash flow. We come from this world. I always want to keep growing that, building things that continue to provide like more income, more freedom, all those kinds of things. Even though like I love my job, I have no intention of leaving it, but the income is a major driver, or actually it's a driver. The bigger driver is that this product is particularly meaningful to me. It represents an idea that occurred to me like at an important point in my life. And I think this is kind of the biggest thing. My job is to write about entrepreneurship and business building. It's hard to do that if you're not an entrepreneur. At least it's hard to do it in a way that's really helpful. And right now I'm not. I'm an employee. What's that?
It's good to hear you say that.
Oh, yeah. I feel that way. I mean, I've certainly struggled to find good information at times when I was running businesses. And I feel it too. So right now I'm an employee. I collect a great paycheck every 2 weeks. It's very easy. And I don't feel that stress that comes with like wondering, you know, where's your next meal going to come from? Or how am I going to pay employees? Or how am I going to pay, you know, product bill and all that kind of stuff? So I know I need to keep a toe in that pool in order to write well at my day job. And so I want to launch something on the side that I can just use as like a laboratory for testing different growth mechanisms, for really just understanding what's going on, like in the world of supply chain logistics, all that stuff. I need to be connected to it. The issue that I'm having is that the product that I want to launch, I don't want to get too deep into it here because I don't want to throw off tests. Actually, by the time this goes up, my test will be done. So the idea for the product is it's a notebook. Specifically, it's like a guided journal for people who struggle with anxiety. I had an experience with this as a younger man, and I ended up coming up with some strategies and like questions that have continued to help me over the years. And basically what I did several years ago is I wrote myself a short book. And the idea of this book, I wanted to write a book about how to face anxiety for a long time. That was going to be how I derived meaning from that experience in my life. And I struggled with this idea of like, well, I don't think I have 300 pages worth of stuff to write about. Like, what the hell do I know about this? And so finally, I worked myself up to a point where I said, well, I'm just going to write a book you can put on the shelf. And then on like some, it's going to be super short. And on some random morning when you wake up feeling anxious, you can just go to that book, read it like over coffee, super short by design. And then hopefully it'll remind you of some things that help like with whatever the process is. So I did a V1 of that back in 2017. And I refound it recently. And I was like, I mean, what is that? 5 years. You know, this is pretty good, but I never really did anything with it. And so I was thinking, I think that's going to be the first product. I want to re-edit it, repackage it, and relaunch it instead of being a short book as like one of those field notes size notebooks. And rather than just a passive reading experience, it would be like the idea would be you basically grab, you buy like three of them at a time. And then when you feel anxious, you grab one, you take half an hour, you go read / work your way through the questions, and then hopefully come out the other side with a clear picture of what's making you anxious or what to do about it. So that's the idea. Here's the problem. The problem is that product is not related to anything that I'm known for, right?
Hey there, it's Tim, and I need to take a moment to tell you about this show's sponsor. It's a product called Hype Fury. When I was able to speak to Yannick, who is the CMO, one of the founding partners of Hype Fury, and he agreed to sponsor the show, I was so thrilled. And the reason is because I have personally used Hype Fury for the last 3 years, And it has allowed me to build my social media following and my personal brand to over 70,000 followers. I could not have done it without Hype Fury. And I really, really mean that. I use this product every day, and it's added so much to my business and to my life. So Hype Fury is a social media scheduling tool. It has three main features that I think separates it from every other tool. One, it allows you to quickly create content and schedule them. So it's a very nuanced feature, but it's so helpful. Basically, I sit down at my desk in the morning and I type out my tweet, I type out my LinkedIn post, and then all I do is I hit enter, and Hype Fury schedules it at the opportune time on Twitter and on LinkedIn. I don't have to think about it any more than that. All I have to do is sit down and create my tweets, create my posts, hit enter, and Hype Fury does all the work for me. Second, Hype Fury makes it so that you can easily create threads. And threads have been the biggest value add for me in growing my following. So threads really help me grow my following on Twitter. And those threads format themselves into longer form LinkedIn posts on LinkedIn. It's actually kind of funny. I made a video about this not too long ago about how, yes, like, you want to create threads on Twitter. You want to be a thread boy, because I'd say like 80% of my growth on both Twitter and LinkedIn have been from threads and long form posts. And I wouldn't have been able to format any of this without using Hype Fury. And then third, Hype Fury is really good for keeping you inspired. So what it does is it shows you some of your most popular tweets and your most popular posts. And it basically gives you information. It gives you inspiration as to what your audience is looking for and what they most actively engage in. So you're never sitting at the computer thinking, oh man, like, what am I going to say today? What kind of content am I going to create today? It's constantly feeding you new ideas, new inspiration, and it allows you to quickly create this content so that you can continuously get yourself out there, continuously build your brand, and most importantly, turn that social media following into newsletter subscribers. So through Hype Fury, I've been able to grow my personal email list, timstodds.com, to over 30,000 followers. That's turned into a business within itself. It's really helped me grow the Copyblogger newsletter. We're at 110,000 followers right now. A whole lot of that is also because of Hype Fury. So please, this is a product that I use every single day. I personally vouch for it. You can check it out at hypefury.com, hypefury.com. And if you have any problems with it, you can send me a DM on Twitter, and I'm sure I can convince you as to why it will add value to your life. So hypefury.com. Thank you so much to Hype Fury for sponsoring the show. And let's get back to the episode.
So we talk about this a lot. If you want to build products, like, the way to build a successful 6-7-figure business in this creator model is, like, first, cash flow, got my job. Second, you build an audience. Third, you build products. I have a small audience, even outside of this podcast. I'm kind of known for, like, newsletter stuff, how to build newsletters, not known at all for anxiety or anything related to journaling or notebooks or any of that stuff. So that's a long prelude to say, I've been struggling, man. Like, I want to bring this product into the world, but I've been struggling to decide whether it's actually worth my time, or am I getting distracted by something that is going to be a major uphill battle? Am I thrashing because of what we talked about earlier? Like, it's just too personal, and so I'm letting those, like, dumb problems get in the way. Or is this just really not a good use of my time right now? I'll pause there. I have a solution I'm going to talk through, just because but I wanted to touch on the issues because I think everybody can relate to this. And if you've never launched something, you can relate to it even more. Like, if you've launched a couple of things, you know that this is just normal and you have to push through it. But if you're new to this, you're probably thinking similar thoughts in your head. And I just wanted to be open about the fact that, like, even once you've been in this game, I've interviewed dozens and dozens of entrepreneurs. I know what the process is. It still trips me up.
I am thrilled to finally hear the idea. When you said you wanted to launch a notebook company, I thought it was much more of like a padded journal. You know, basically you were binding a journal, because I know that you have a thing for like leather bound notebooks, and it's like a comfort thing for you as well. And so I thought that's where you're going. Like, I'm just going to make my own brand of leather bound notebooks. I didn't realize that it was going to be something to read and an experience that has guided exercises and prompts. That's the word I'm looking for, and has prompts. So I love everything about this idea, Ethan. And if I didn't like it, I would 100% tell you. And I can tell you why. As somebody that studies search metrics on a daily basis, there is so much interest in anxiety relief online. There's a ton of interest for, I don't know what you would call it. I don't want to be too clinical because like I'm not a clinician, right? So if I phrase it improperly, please forgive me. But almost like secondary things, like impulsive behavior type things, like I'm feeling anxious and so I do this. I'm feeling squirrely, so I do this. Like, how do I stop scrolling social media? Like secondary phrases that like are rooted in the base of anxiety. And from an SEO perspective, which is always where my head goes, that's a no-brainer to me. I think you should do this right away because it would be openly applauded and accepted. And I'm sure even as people listen to this episode, we're going to get some DMs about like, wow, I love that idea. I would buy that book right now. Also, in terms of like the rebranding yourself type thing, I've thought about this a lot because I was that, you know, before I got into the Twitter content marketing world, I was just the sober guy on the internet. And it was hard for me to kind of break out of that. And there were a lot of times where I had in my head, like, maybe this is just my thing. Maybe this is just my shtick and like I should stick with it. Why am I trying to reinvent myself? But the reason was because I have more to give, right? And as much as I've never met Gary Vaynerchuk and I respect him a lot, I give him a hard time sometimes when I talk about it, just because I think his message can like really, really be diluted and not practical. But every time I check out some of Gary V's videos or something like that, I am continuously impressed and continuously reminded about how easily people can be in different communities at the same time and like adequately represent themselves. You know, he's in sports cards, he's in wine, he's in social media, now he's in NFTs. What else is he in? Video games, Twitch, you know, he's into hip hop, he's into SoundCloud, sneakers. And like, I have this weird love-hate relationship with Gary Vee. I'm not trying to make this podcast episode about him, but every time I go through that personal journey and sort of argument, let's say, in my head, the conflict in my head about reinventing myself, I always think about him and all the work that he's done, because I know it's possible. And I know that people are openly willing to accept the fact that people are more than one thing, right? So It's valid, totally valid that you feel that way. I'm not trying to like invalidate how you're feeling, but I would certainly encourage you to see all of the examples about how people can break out of that and quickly.
Totally. Yeah. Well, thanks for saying that, man. I appreciate the validation of that idea. And I think there's a part of me that knows the idea itself is, it could work, partly based on the market, like you said, and then partly based on just, you know, I've had this experience enough times in my life to know that it's worth pursuing something that you want to do just because you want to do it.
Yep.
And like a lot of times those things click into place and they work in a way that you couldn't have predicted beforehand. And you should do them. But the caveat to that is you should not like leave your job to go do something that you want to do just because you want to do it. Again, just to go back to our normal model, it's like cash flow first, then you build the audience, then you build the product. If you have that cash flow, you can experiment on different things until the cows come home and they can all fail. It doesn't matter as much. And I've made that mistake. You know, I've done hard pivots into new products before. And so I've learned that lesson. I think at this point, I'm going to do it anyways. The real thing I was trying to solve is like, well, how much of my attention should this get? Because I've got a full-time job. You know, we've got the podcast. I've got travel that I want. I'm, you know, young, single. Like I want to have a life outside of work as well. And I think it's important to be open about this too with people who are listening. The reality is I don't really think there's any such thing as passive cash flow. I think at least at this level, whatever you start is going to take up basically as much time as it possibly can, right? And where that starts to change is when you have enough money to hire other people in to manage the tasks, right? So Sean was talking about this on My First Million recently. He had this whole big thing about how like it's ridiculous to do a whole VC backed startup because, well, he has lots of reasons. But one of the things that he said inside of that was, if you're going to try and start anything, a small business and a massive business are going to take like roughly the same amount of time. So yeah. The temptation is to just go for gold and build a massive business, even though the odds might be way lower. So the reality is, this is going to take a lot of time, and how much should I dedicate to it? And so here's how I'm thinking through this. The first thing that I need to know is whether or not I can reach this target audience, because I know I have something to say, and eventually I could reach them, right? So I could start building towards this. But before I'm going to like start spending all my nights and weekends on this, I need to know if right now I have the reach to make this work. Because if I don't, fine, I'll keep chipping away at it in the background. And maybe I start releasing a Twitter thread every once in a while about like how different founders handle anxiety or whatever it is. And I can start inching my way into that. So what I did to test that was I took a chapter of the book, turned it into a Twitter thread, and released it. And I've set a benchmark for engagement on that post. And originally I was thinking like 100 likes. So I have not been tweeting very actively. And as a result, if I put out anything that's like really informative, I'll get somewhere between like 30 and 50 likes on it, right? Which is about, it's like a little over 1% of my audience, which I think is fine for like something that's kind of dormant. I don't really do it actively. So I can flip it on and get like 30 to 50 people to like, a couple of shares, a couple hundred impressions or whatever. So I set the benchmark at double that to make it difficult, right? Because if I'm going to invest time that is currently free in doing this, this really needs to kind of prove itself. But also to see what kind of cross section of my audience relates to the idea already. And I'm learning two interesting things. So I released this a couple hours before we hopped on here. And interestingly, the tweet's been up for 4 hours and it's only got 9 likes, which means it's actually significantly underperformed as far as tweets go on my channel, which is good data to have. It's had about 3,000 impressions. So the engagement rate is pretty low for me. And there are like about 100 detail expands, like 120 people have clicked on it, no new followers, more retweets than normal, which is interesting, right? So it's like helpful, but for whatever reason, not a lot of people like it. So it hasn't hit the bar yet that I would have, it hasn't hit the bar to be a no-brainer, but I'm learning something else that's interesting, right? I don't think I currently have the reach to make this my top priority. Like I wouldn't pull a late night to get this product off the ground right now. But I am getting comments, DMs, and retweets at a rate that I don't typically, where that I see, but I'm a little bit surprised by. Just there, it's like a higher proportion of the engagement is people reaching out and either saying that they liked it or commenting that it was helpful. And what that's showing me is potential marketing paths. So some of the people that have reached out, like, you know how like when you break your audience down, there's kind of two audiences that you have. You have your Gen Pop, right? Like the audience of people who follow, like, kind of casually know you. And then there's your other creators, friends, right? And sometimes they engage with your stuff. And when they do, it's kind of like a bonus because it's like, oh yeah, like somebody in the game likes this work. A high percentage of the engagements are coming from those types of people, which is telling me that even though I can't necessarily reach this audience out of the gate, I do have friends and relationships who find this important enough that there might be some kind of affiliate model that could be used to expand my reach if I decide to pull the trigger. So the experiment hasn't been a complete bust, but I wanted to just talk through how I'm thinking about it. And I'll cap it off by saying this. The priority for me right now, as I mentioned, was to figure out if I can reach this audience out of the gate, right? Do people who care about this also care about what I'm already talking about? If they do, it's a no-brainer. I've been thinking about, like, there's kind of an equation for business, and it's very simple. There's three parts to it. Can you reach your target audience? Can you talk about your product in a way that makes them want it? And then can you deliver your product in an economically feasible manner? If you can do those three things, you've got a profitable business and there's no question to it, right? Like, that's it. But I think it's easy to overthink it and also to skip those steps and overfocus on product development before even reaching the audience. That's what I'm trying not to do.
I see your viewpoint. It's funny because I am, to a fault, much more the other direction. I am much more along the lines of, like, you know what? I don't mind waking up at 4:30 in the morning for the next month. I got to know if there's something here, where I don't think I've ever, like, ever tested something for viability. I've gone for it and then eventually gone through. I know that you and Tim Ferriss has had an impression on you, and he wrote a blog post a long time ago about when to quit. And I've read that blog post and I kind of use it as a reference where it's like, this ain't going to work. It's nothing personal. Time to quit. And so I guess I would offer a counterbalance to it, where people regret the things that they don't do more than they regret the things that they do do. Mm. And I suppose this is part of my personality. It's a blessing. It's a curse. I'm not really sure, but I wouldn't be able to, like, go to sleep at night if I felt like I had this idea that wanted to come out of me, that I wasn't at least giving, not necessarily my full effort, but I wasn't giving what I knew inside was needed to be done. Because I am a realist in that way. Like, energy is a real thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, you have priorities, you have relationships, like, you got to sleep. You want to sit and relax and read books. I'm not about that. But I am about, I'm a redliner, basically. Like, if there's something I need to do, the goal for me is, let me redline to see if I can get it done. And at least I'll know. And if I can't get it done and it's just not a thing that makes a lot of sense, I'll know. So my t-shirt company was a really good example of this. Like, I gave it my best shot and it's still out there. It's still live. You know, some stuff happens to it, but it doesn't sit in my mind anymore because, like, I know. What else was I going to do? I did everything I could have done. And so you're, even in your line of work, like, your position at your employment is very much along the lines of, like, data and aggregation and not overthinking, but being methodical. Whereas I can't relate to that as much, you know? And so I suppose if there was a counter argument to it, it would be, yeah. Everything that you said makes a whole lot of sense. And you should totally, totally forget it. Like, you should totally ignore it and just wake up at 4:30 in the morning for the next month and work on it for an hour a day.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, the data that you have right now is complete data, but it's also very, like, misaligned data because there's emotional stigmas to it, right? Like, how many people saw it and thought to themselves, oh, wow, this is really interesting, but they're not going to share it with their friends. There's different, like, mediums for it. Like, Twitter probably isn't the best spot for that anyway, you know. Like, I would go to Medium, where everybody loves talking about their emotions, to see what happens. So
yeah, well, so there's a part of me that agrees with you. Maybe I should clarify too, this is for me about resource allocation. Sure. And that is kind of a data nerdy thing to say, but what I mean by that is I'm gonna do it because I want it, right?
Oh yeah.
And I already have like a V1 because I already wrote the book. But I want it in this, like, notebook form. And mm-hmm. So I'm going to do that. And I've got a budget that I'm willing to pay a certain amount just to create this, just so that I have a box of these in my closet that I can use when I want them. And that's enough. And I've already seen from the feedback on the tweet that these ideas resonate with at least a handful of people. And to me, that's enough too, right? Like, it doesn't have to be a life-changing business, because the impact of just helping one person is enough to make an experience like that meaningful. What I'm currently testing is to determine how much of my attention, of my time and attention, is this going to get at a time when I also, like, I feel kind of spread thin because I am
Do you launching feel that other way, though? Really?
Spread thin or yeah. like it's actually worth it? Oh yeah, like not overly spread thin, but this is an important enough decision for me where I'm going to, I don't have a ton of extra time and attention to give to this. So if it's going to be a major priority, it really needs to clear a certain hurdle for me. And if not, and it doesn't seem like it's going to clear that hurdle, fine. That means I have basically mornings on the weekends for me are when I develop these side projects. And fine, then it gets that time. And so it'll definitely come out. It'll probably, you know, be in the next month or so. But it was really important for me to set that hurdle and put something out in public because I got to tell you, man, as soon as I decided to write this tweet thread, I stopped for like a week because I couldn't figure out how to word things. And I was really worried that I was going to offend somebody or whatever. All the normal bullshit that you go through when you try to put something out. And I know now. That the most important thing is to push through that and just put something out. So I did. There's like a lot of, it's checking a lot of boxes and a lot of these, like they're very small wins, but let me tell you something. So the reason this was a priority for me, the testing is because, you know, I've at this point interviewed, you know, dozens of people who've built 6, 7, 8, 9-figure companies off of ideas that they've had in the background. And a lot of them, or the ones that I like the most, I'll say, the ones that really appeal to me as types of successes that I want to have in my portfolio, all seemed to start roughly the same way, which is these people are creators and they're constantly trying little things. They're putting little things out, but it's not a huge investment of effort. They're just trying little things. And then every once in a while, something hits and they're like, oh, hey, it seems like people are interested in this. Would you like me to offer an example? So I have three examples I can throw at you if you're interested.
Love that.
Cool. So my favorite would be Steph Smith. She's a colleague of mine and she's written two books now. One's on content strategy. One is on time management. Both of those books generate multi six figures or at least 6+ figures per year each, which is very rare in book publishing of any kind. Her first book, Doing Content Right, started as a tweet thread where she basically said something like, I just found a document on my computer that's all about, you know, the rules that I established in running a content team, basically how to do content marketing. You know, it's 150 pages now. If I finish this and offer it for sales, it's something people would want to buy. It got so much attention, and by so much, I mean like a couple hundred likes, that she immediately that same day went and built a Gumroad page and said she didn't put any effort into the product. She just said, like, here's what I'm making. Here's what you're going to get. Here's the price point. And then she went back to the Twitter thread literally within a couple of hours and said, hey, it seems like there's a lot of interest. I put up a page. If you want, you can pre-order. So that's the second hurdle, right? Like if nobody pre-orders, boom, I'm not investing my time in this. Whole bunch of people pre-ordered. And then she pulled a Tim, a Stasi, and like, burnt the candle at both ends for a couple of weeks, got that puppy out and like launched it and
wrote
it killed.
Fast.
She did.
I couldn't believe how long it was when I was like, you wrote this thing in like a month and a half and there's not a single spelling mistake in it.
Which it's gorgeous too. Like it's like well designed. There's a Kindle version of it. She launched like a cohort based class off of it. She's incredible. But it had to clear those hurdles in order to deserve her attention. And I would suspect, maybe you don't, but I'd suspect you actually you do some version of that yourself, but maybe it's just on autopilots that like it's deeper in your intuition. By the time you're ready to just go, you've already seen enough signals where you're like, this is going to be a thing. So I'm just going to go do it. Maybe I'm wrong, but personally, I need to put those in place because I've wasted too much time building something that never gets sold to keep doing it. So I'm going to do this. But it's got to clear some hurdles before it deserves more of my attention. And then there's other examples too, like Sam does that, and Dharmesh, the guy who created HubSpot, does that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm with that, I suppose, because of my Brian Clark influence. I approach it maybe with a longer timeline, whereas, because even what you're saying is very interesting, where you said, I want to create the product anyway, just to have it. And then, like, if I can sell them, that's great. I would never, ever, ever do that. I would never spend money on a product that I know people aren't going to buy. And so I think my patience has benefited me here, because in anything I've ever launched, I already had an audience for it. Yep. So like the data point for me isn't necessarily like, is there a tweet? Is there a survey? The data point for me is creating content that I enjoy creating, at least to the extent that like I enjoy writing enough that I know people are going to get help from it, you know? And then if there's an audience that gets built over the course of a month, 2 months or whatever, then I know that people will buy it, because they've already basically told me by signing up to the newsletter. And it's the same thing over and over again. But to me, I think the mistake a lot of people make, especially people with physical products, by the way, I've written articles about this where the example I made was like the kitchen helper. Some guy has like I thought about it from infomercials, right? Where, you know, that crazy thing that has a little plastic container and then you hit your fist on the top of it and it chops. Yeah. The chop it up type thing. I was like, how much money had to go into the product development of this thing? You know, like all the patents.
I was just going to say patents.
Trial and error, right? Like at least a couple $100,000. And then they build the thing and they're like, okay, now we got to sell it. And so what do? They go hit infomercials. And I just remember seeing that, thinking like, that's got to be so damn stressful. So damn stressful, because it's an idea that like people are going to buy this. I know they are. Where it's so much easier for me to cash flow. You have the cash flow. And what's the next step? The next step isn't sell. The next step is distribution, right? And so like in my mind, there's no rush. Anxiety is not going to go anywhere. So write about it for a year. And if you got 5,000 emails a year later, you can sell it easily. You can sell it on autopilot forever.
This is where the concept of the landing page comes in. So I don't have one yet. I sat down to build one. And as I sat down to build one, I got hamstrung between two different ideas, which is because I agree, obviously, we like co-created this framework. I was basically thinking to myself, do I want to create a landing page that tries to describe the individual product and sell it? Or I have this kind of bigger vision to create a broader company over time that does a lot of these guided type journals that deal with different areas, sort of like Best Self Co., which does several million dollars a year and people love it. And so the broader idea was, well, maybe I just created a landing page that talks about like, hey, like, do you like journaling and self-reflection? Like, sign up here to be a journal tester, because we're building a whole brand around this. And every once in a while, we'll send you like cool interviews or like sections of journals that are in development. And you can let us know. This is what the guy who founded Brewmate did this. Basically, if you haven't heard of it, Brewmate is a company that sells like basic insulated cups for drinks, or like insulated beer koozies. And they're made out of metal and they're really expensive. And the guy who built it to like $100 million or something in the first 3 or 4 years. And the first $30 million he built, it was a one-man show. He was just working with like 3PLs and contractors in order to do everything. And the way he started was he had an idea for, I think, something he called the wine insulator, which was like an insulated bottle of wine. So like you could, it was an a Yeti mug that could fit an entire bottle of wine. And he put up a landing page for it. He ponied up the cash to start developing this thing with a manufacturer, but he created a one-page landing page that said, hey, if you think you want this, like put your email address here and we'll let you know when it's ready. And then, you know, he just paid for Facebook ads to run Facebook ads straight to that page. Gathered somewhere between like 5,000 and 7,000 emails. And that was enough to kickstart this product so that they were profitable from day one. And the biggest problem he's ever had is just making sure they keep enough inventory on hand. So I know the power of building that audience. And that's what I'm working to make sure is like, I don't want to over invest in the product side before I know that I have that distribution. I think that's enough about this product. I wanted to give people like a quick heads up there. But before we wrap this up, let's give maybe one more example of this whole audience thing, because we wanted to start doing like more case studies here. And I have this case study for how a woman I know, we've actually mentioned her on the show before, Lexi Grant, built her audience to 1,000 people and then ended up selling ads against that audience at $5,000 a pop. Do you, and it ties in with everything that we're talking about here. So do you want to talk about this or should we do it next time?
I need to know how this is even possible. How do you have an email list with the $5,000 ad charge on it?
Totally. Okay. So I'll go through it quick then. And the first thing you need to know is that Lexi has a deep background in media companies. Part of the reason she was able to sell ads was just because she knew the value of what she was selling. A lot of newsletter creators just don't. And so they're dramatically undercharging. But quick background. So she's basically been in the media game most of her career. She was a journalist, like traveled all the way through Africa, worked for US News and World Report, and then started a content company back in the mid 2000s, I think. That was basically acqui-hired into the Penny Hoarder. Okay. I don't know if you've heard of the Penny Hoarder?
Of course.
Okay. Tim said, of course, people listening to this may not have heard of it because here's the crazy thing. The Penny Hoarder, it was huge. It grew to like, she grew the team there to like 100+ and tens of millions of monthly viewers. And the Penny Hoarder was eventually sold for $100 million. That was a bootstrapped media company sold for $100 million. Got practically no press, right? So media guys like Tim have heard of them, but most people have not. So she was, you know, part of the growth of that company, was acqui-hired into it, ended up leaving before the sale and started her own company called The Write Life, which is all about teaching writers how to make money. And then she had an exit on that too. So she's like a total baller in the media game and knows what's going on. But the thing is, when she went through those different acquisitions, there weren't a lot of case studies for people who'd done the same thing. And the reason is because the media only focuses on like these huge business valuations, huge business deals, anything in the 5, 6, or 7 figure range pretty much gets ignored. So that became the inspiration for this new list that she's building. It's called They Got Acquired. It's all about acquisitions in like the from $500,000 up to, I think, or no, sorry, 100,000 to like 50 million. So the two quick things, right? That's her background. How did she grow the list? And then how did she monetize it? And this is where it ties in with what we talked about today. She grew the list first by talking about the idea. And I think this is something that a lot of people screw up. You touched on this with the whole patent thing. Yeah. People take forever to talk about their ideas because they're worried somebody's going to steal them.
Yeah.
You got to ditch that.
Yeah.
You got to ditch it. If the idea is any good, yeah, people should try, like they should try to steal it, but they're probably not going to because most people don't execute on anything. Right. But you got to get your idea out there. So she specifically shared this idea in two places. One was kernel.ai. Or wait, actually, no, I've got that wrong. I think it's just kernel. kernel.ai. You know, there are some shows that don't do public math. We should agree not to do public spelling.
Yeah, we're writers and public grammar. Why on earth would I know grammar?
That reminds me too. I'm listening to this book now on the history of the English language and why it's so much different. Sorry, why is American English so much different from British English?
Wow.
It's really interesting. It was written by Bill Bryson. It's called Made in America. And it's about the split between those two languages and how they ended up the way that they did. It's really good. I recommend listening to it because I think reading it might be a little bit tedious, but several points in the book, they always reference these old documents and they're like, oh yeah, you know, in the Declaration of Independence, they spell freedom three different ways, like E-E-D-O-M, D-O-M-E. And I'm like, yeah, because they wrote it all by hand. And like, I screw stuff up when I'm writing by hand, you know, at a certain point, you're just not going to make another copy of that damn thing. So I don't think it's like a cultural thing, you know, kernel is K-E-R-N-A-L. And it's a place to share startup ideas. She shared it there, got a little bit of feedback, enough to keep going. And then she started sharing updates on Indie Hackers, right? Built. And this is where, to your point, she started building the audience. So she would do these weekly and then monthly updates on how the product, how the build was going. We'll link to it in the show notes if anybody wants to check out what that progression looked like. But she shared the idea. And that's the biggest thing. You got to get that idea out there and don't worry about people stealing it. Honestly, if somebody else steals it and runs off with it, one of two things happened. Either you weren't executing fast enough or like, congratulations, you had a great idea. Like, yeah. Go do it. Also, just these days, there's not a limit on the number of people who can do an idea.
Exactly. There's no zero sum of success on that. That's the part of when people do take something of mine, like I remember t-shirt designs getting copied and then put out there, the first thing I would thought was like, okay, cool, it's a good idea. So like I should just press it harder and win, because obviously people are going to buy that. So I'll stop there before I go off on a tangent. But if people aren't excited about your idea, that's way worse. Think of it that way. You know?
The next step was related to sharing the idea and list growth. So as she started to build the company, she built a quick landing page. I looked at it before. I think she used ClickFunnels. And just a quick ClickFunnels page, but she started sharing the idea via email with people that she knew. And here's how she did it. This was really smart. Instead of just saying like, hey, I'm starting this thing, will you sign up? She said, hey, I'm starting this company. We want to highlight acquisitions that are in this range that never get highlighted. Do you know of any deals that you think we should cover? And then two things would happen. People would share story ideas, which was great because she was sourcing data that was like hard to come by. And most of the time, they'd click through and sign up, and they'd be like, hey, this is great. Like, let me know when it starts.
Yeah.
So sharing that idea is going to be the key that gets you going. It builds your audience. It validates the plan, all this kind of stuff. Over time, she grew up to about 1,000 people, and it took them like 4 or 5 months to pre-build enough content in order to launch. As soon as they hit about 1,000 people, she started selling ads in the newsletter. And she did it with, I saw it, she sent it to me. It's a 2-page document. And this is what it basically offers. It says, you know, here is the idea for the company. Like, this is the type of audience that we're going after. We're going to launch with like 1,000 person email list. And here's what you get for your ad. You're going to get, let me just make sure I get this right, because I want to get the numbers right. 1,000 subscribers, 65% open rate. Okay, so here's what you get. 4 newsletter placement, 2 podcast placements, and 2 shout outs on Twitter, right? So that's a total of 8 shout outs to a growing audience of a few thousand people. Cost, $5,000. Apparently it was so successful that she actually changed her plan for monetizing the business originally. I mean, and you know, she's still got other ideas for like these back end products that we've talked about in other episodes.
Yeah.
But she didn't plan for advertising to be a big part of it. And she said there's just so much demand that now it's going to be a big part of it. So the big takeaways for the audience who may or may not be listening to this is you got to share that idea, right? And like specifically individual outreach can be really helpful early on. Gave her a very active, very engaged list.
We talked about that with the episode with Nathan with ConvertKit, how he scaled it all through one-on-one outreach. So yes, I agree.
Yes. Yep. And then know the value of those readers, and you can just kind of ballpark it, but start high. You know, 8 placements, roughly 1,000 people. She's building a high net worth audience, right? These are people who are interested in business acquisitions. But you can sell these ads with just a 2-page Google Doc that explains your vision, lays out the opportunity, and is just very open about like, hey, this is what we're charging. Do you want it?
That's so fascinating to me. My brain is racing right now because I've always hated the ad model for the exact reason that I just never thought there was any money in it. But
Hustle was all ads before we were acquired, man. I'm doing like millions of dollars a year in ads.
Sure. But you guys had 1 million subscribers. That's different. Like the vast majority of people probably have 1,000 to 1,500, 5,000 subscribers, you know? And so if you're at a $45 CPM, unless you're writing a daily newsletter, you're thinking, so what's 45 times 5 if you're getting an entire 100% open rate? So
like $250.
Yeah, something like that. Great. So $250 a week. That's really, really cool. And
no, it's not. Like if,
yeah, it's not that cool. Okay, let's just say it. So, but what you said really resonated with me, where the demand right now for media attention is so freaking high that it's probably like an advertiser's market right now, where it's like, okay, you don't want to buy the ad, then don't. I don't really care. It doesn't matter to me. I'll go to the next person. Maybe we should look into that. Is there like a wave of self-published advertising going on right now?
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge because of the changes that
Oh, the iOS
Google,
update on Facebook.
Facebook and Apple have made recently. It's just too expensive. And so people are looking at all these secondary markets. And, you know, a media company last year or like 2 years ago, they probably doubled their ad revenue in this time. It's huge. There's a framework people can use to think about this too. If like, I don't know, we've probably talked about this at some point, but just to give people one more time, it's important to realize that you can monetize these small lists at a really healthy level. And Lexi was smart about this because she said, she's like, look, this had to be worth a certain amount for us to even invest in taking the time to do it. Because if you can't sell this at like $5,000, or I would say like minimum $2,500 per week, you don't have the time to go through all the steps involved in working with advertisers. So just find another way to make money, go get a side job or something like that until you can hit that level. There's sort of two ways to think about this. The first is I'll give you a very clear framework. There are three pieces at play in the pricing of an ad. It's how big is your audience? How engaged are they? And how much money do they have to spend? Mm-hmm. And what you really need is you need two of those things. So if you have a big audience and they're super engaged, right, you can monetize even at relatively low CPMs because there's just so many of them. And that's kind of how like large lists like The Hustle or Morning Brew made millions of dollars because they have those big followings. But if you have a tiny list and they've got a lot of money or like, and they're, you know, really engaged, which I think is more like what Lexi did here, you can also make great money that way. So those three things, right, will help you figure out when you're ready to monetize ads. How big is your list? How active are they? And how much money do they have to spend? And the way to think about it is how much money, because a lot of people will ask, they're like, well, what do I charge for ads? There is no one answer. The only way to think about this is to think, how much money do your advertisers make when somebody buys from them? And like, how many sales can you send them? That has to be worth it mathematically for them. And then that's kind of how you charge. And then this is where the second answer comes into play. That first framework feels very official. The reality is when you go to sell ads out of the gate, it's kind of a shot in the dark. You just send an email, you're trying to get somebody's attention, offer them an audience, and start with a price. And if they say yes, the next time you sell the ad, it's got to be more expensive.
Go for more.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
This is probably a perfect place to come full circle here. We can wrap this up on this. I got to get ready for Muay Thai. But as we relaunch Sober Nation, I have been building an email list for the last 10 years that I've never done anything with. I send a weekly newsletter of just like some links and I RSS feed it a lot. I got 17,000 people on my list and it's got an open rate of like 5,000 or 50%, excuse me. And I was just talking to David about this, saying like, look, I don't care what we do. We need to try something because this doesn't make any sense for us to just sit here with it. And so fascinating because the cost per click on Google for addiction treatment is up to like $100 per click. And I'm not joking. It's probably one of the top three. It's like addiction treatment, debt settlement, and like personal injury law. You know, those are just the real swimming with the sharks. But what's fascinating is because it's such an important thing, there is, like, you can't advertise it on Facebook and you have to get registered through a company called LegitScript. It's basically a certification process to say, like, yes, you are a credible facility and like, we will allow you to advertise. So there's a ton of advertising dollars out there that are floating around that we've always thought to ourselves, but who's going to sponsor a newsletter? And after listening to this and listening to Lexi Graham, you said her name was, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to write like a page and a half document and maybe we'll send it out to all the listeners just to be like, hey, we're doing it over here. Let's see what you're doing. And I'm going to try to sell some newsletter ads, man. I'm going to go for it.
Do it up. Let's see. And we'll report back on what happens. Everybody listening to this, if you want to get the data on what happens, make sure to tune in. And I think this was good, man. Well, let's wrap it up there.
I can't wait to follow up on. I appreciate you like sharing that idea with me. Honestly, I'm really excited about it. Like, I'm pumped about it. It's going to kill it. Yeah. So, all right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you so much for supporting the show. I've gotten more DMs this last week, basically than the last week a couple of weeks combined with people giving us compliments about the podcast. I think just the consistency is really starting to pay off and people are starting to get to know us. So thank you for all that. The kind words do not go unnoticed. Give us a like, give us a subscribe, tell a friend. It's the best thing you can do to support the show. We appreciate you. We'll talk to you next week.